WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. News of the sequester was inescapable this week. Sweeping budget cuts, which, if they're allowed to go through on March 1st, could seriously damage the economy. Who's to blame? Everybody!
Both sides are responsible for it, and both sides seem resigned to it.
You have a set of politicians who, on both sides, who are unwilling to deal with something that they created because it was a way for them to kick the can down the road.
Now the only question is, who's going to get the blame?
This all feels very familiar. Last month it was the looming debt ceiling disaster. This month, the sequestration. Different name, same ominous rumblings of financial ruin. In his State of the Union address, President Obama made reference to the syndrome.
The greatest nation on earth cannot keep conducting its business by drifting from one manufactured crisis to the next.
But that's just what we seem to be doing. This latest crisis began in 2011 when, as you'll recall, Republicans demanded huge cuts in exchange for raising the debt limit, which Democrats wanted to do. They hammered out a compromise that would raise the debt ceiling while the so-called super committee found ways to cut spending and raise revenue agreeable to both sides. But the super committee failed, so next month sequestration will kick in. $1.2 trillion of cuts over 10 years that would hurt everyone, and everyone's to blame.
Mainstream media are happy when they can point fingers at everybody. Nonpartisan blame has no political downside. The problem with the shame on everyone false equivalency is that it doesn't answer basic questions you might have about the sequester. New York Magazine writer Jonathan Chait says he's found a perfect example of this phenomenon, a Washington Post op-ed that dismissed the Republican position on the sequester, argued against the feasibility of the Democrats' position, even though the paper had previously supported it, and omitted the president's position altogether. All this, says Chait, was in the name of appearing nonpartisan.
I know that the Post agrees with Obama's general position on the deficit. The proposition that there needs to be some balance between revenue and cuts to retirement programs is exactly the stated position the Post has. Omitting this is bizarre. It sure seemed to me that the Post was caught between its desire to be nonpartisan and the fact that on this issue it happens to agree with President Obama, and so was forced to work away this contradiction by just ignoring Obama's actual position.
This need to appear nonpartisan, is this more common in some areas than in others?
It's extremely common on the deficit. The problem is this. Neutral reporters and self-styled centrist commentators almost uniformly agree that the deficit is a vital, urgent problem and that it's crucial to address this problem through a combination of higher tax revenue and lower spending on retirement programs, and end up advocating for a position, thinking that they're not actually advocating it because it's merely a sort of public good that everyone who knows anything understands must happen. The problem is that their position is embraced by one of the parties and not by the other. They're caught in a quandary. They can't concede that one of the parties actually agrees with them. So to maintain their nonpartisanship while advocating for a position in the debate that one of the parties has taken, they have to conceal the fact that one of the parties actually agrees with them and misleadingly present the issue as one where neither party agrees with them.
A news consumer that wants balanced news doesn't want to go to partisan news sources. So they go to nonpartisan places. And then they get nonpartisaned to the point where they aren't being informed?
Well, I think that can actually happen. Partisanship can infect news coverage, and it can infect opinion commentary and introduce a bias. The problem is, if you only correct for that bias, and you go so far as to define non-biased in a way that prevents you from accurately describing differences between the parties, then you've not corrected the bias, you've simply replaced it with a different kind of bias.
The other kinds of biases have to do with
a priori centrism that defines the correct position as necessarily being the middle ground between the two parties at all times.
You know, exploring this conundrum with you leaves me open to charges like the one that was hurled at me by conservative John Sununu prior to the election.
As usual, you, part of the liberal press that will cover this president's butt across the board, you're going to lose in November.
So what do I say to Sununu?
Well, my answer here isn't that neutral reporters should advocate Obama's position. Because the problem is, once they've started advocating a position, especially on this issue, then they're caught in a trap where they can't describe the positions of the parties honestly without seeming biased. But I think it's worth noting that if you're dedicated to stopping that kind of bias, but not aware of the other kind of bias, you can make equally ridiculous mistakes in the other direction.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Chait is a writer for New York Magazine.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.